Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for choosing to hear more of my voice. I'm going to be sick of my voice at the end of today, so I kind of feel sorry for you. But I'm glad that a good number of people want to think about what is such an important and prominent topic for us at the moment in the UK and in many Western nations, certainly. I'm going to get straight into it. You may well be aware that trans identification is an increasing and sort of fast-growing phenomenon among young people. I'll define what I mean by that in just a moment. So if you're thinking, hang on a minute, I need to catch up on this, don't worry. But we can see the fact this is becoming a fast-paced, fast-growing thing in various ways. One is in the pure numbers of young people being referred to GIDS, which is the NHS Under 18 Gender Clinic. A decade ago, back in 2011 to 2012, there were just 210 referrals. In the last financial year, 21 to 22, there were over 5,000 referrals. That is the scale of increase that we've seen in just 10 years. There's something going on. There's this huge phenomenon happening. That's in the stats, but many of us will be aware as well of kind of recognising this in real life. Young people we know, maybe we're parents, maybe we're youth leaders, church leaders, just members of churches and communities where young people are. And chances are, if you know a young person, you're hearing something around questions around gender and trans identification. I could pretty much guarantee there won't be a teenager in our churches who doesn't know someone at school or in some context who's identifying as trans in some way. And so for us as Christians and as churches, that kind of raises the question of, well, how do we respond to what's going on? We want to love young people. We want to serve them well. Many of us will have young people in our churches. How do we, in the context of what's going on, best love them, best serve them, support them? It might be a question of how do we help families who gender questioning is directly impacting them? How do we as churches support them? That's some of what we're going to try and talk about today as we talk about a better community for trans-identifying teens. And I should make sure I say right at the top of this, this is a hugely complex area. We can't cover everything in an hour. I can't give all the answers. I don't think I have all the answers. I'm not sure anyone has all the answers. This has been a quickly, kind of fast-paced, emerging phenomenon that we don't fully understand yet. But what I'm hoping is I can give you a beginning understanding, some thoughts on what's going on, and then some initial ideas and wisdom that we as Christians and churches might take and apply to help in this kind of context. So let's start by talking about kind of the current situation and understanding what is going on. Helpful just to do some definitions first. I know for many of us this is just hard to keep up with what we're talking about. I've mentioned already today that trans or transgender is this really broad umbrella term for experiences where someone has some sort of disconnect between their body, their biological sex, and what that seems to say about who they are, and how they kind of feel themselves to be inside. You can hear in that there are two different concepts, two different things there. One is this concept of sex, or biological sex. That's what our bodies say about whether we're a man or a woman, a boy or a girl. It's things like chromosomes, gonads, genitals, hormones, the biological realities of our body. But then also there's this concept of gender that we have talked about today, this internal sense of being a man or a woman, a boy or a girl. And trans describes that reality of some people experience a disconnect or a tension, a difference between those two things. And it's an umbrella term, and under there would fall many other different things. You might hear young people talk about being non-binary or gender fluid or gender queer. They're all different, more specific ways of describing or identifying an experience, all of which fall under this broad thing of trans. In some way, they're about a difference between what the body is saying and how one feels himself to be inside. And it's worth noting that under that trans umbrella, therefore, is huge diversity. Diversity of experiences, diversity of responses to those experiences, diversity of kind of what may be going on under the surface, as it were. And it's really important for us not to either go away from here thinking, okay, we know what that is, or to meet one trans identifying teen and think, oh yeah, we get this. But actually, to remember, there is such diversity. Some people say if you've met one trans person, you've met one trans person, in the sense of we can't universalise everything we observe or learn from one person. And so as in all our pastoring, if we're in a leadership position, as in all our just being good Christians walking alongside other people, we want to treat people as individuals and hear from them and hear their stories and value them in that way. And it's also just worth saying some trans-identifying teens would experience gender dysphoria, that clinical diagnosis that can be given when there's significant distress. Some young people actually wouldn't meet a criteria for a medical diagnosis of gender dysphoria. And one of the kind of debates in the trans conversation is, do you need to be able to have a medical diagnosis to identify as trans? Arguably, many teenagers identifying as trans today wouldn't meet the criteria, which are quite high criteria actually to meet to be diagnosed. But they're still experiencing some level of questions and discomfort around their gender identity. That's a bit of definition concepts just to hopefully get vague on the same page of what we're talking about. And let's just touch on then what's actually going on at the moment. I've mentioned the last decade being really significant in this topic. That huge increase we're seeing in the numbers of young people identifying as trans and questioning their gender identity. Just 10 years ago, or just over 10 years ago now actually, I was finishing sixth form college. I don't think I knew anyone who was trans, and I don't think I would have had much of a concept of what it meant to be trans if someone asked me then. Only 10 years later, which isn't a long time really in the grand scheme of things, isn't it? Trans is one of the most prominent things young people are talking about, hearing about, and as I've said, I'm pretty much guarantee any teenager will know someone who themselves is identifying as trans. It's kind of quite a shocking thing how quickly significant change has happened. I've mentioned the increase in the referrals to the gender clinic of the NHS, a more than 2,300% increase in 10 years. What we've also seen, though, is a change in demographics. So there have always been young people who've been uncomfortable with their gender, who haven't felt that their body speaks about who they are. But they've been relatively small numbers. And historically, up until 10 years ago, it was vast majority boys and usually pre-puberty, kind of under the age of 12. What we're seeing now is it's majority girls and it's majority during teenage years and at or after the onset of puberty. That's just interesting to note. Not only the numbers rocketing, but actually the type of young person wrestling this way has really changed, and that kind of raises some question marks for us. It's also very noticeable that the kind of population, the group of young people who are questioning their gender identity, identify as trans, are in many ways not representative of the wider population of teenagers. A disproportionate number of these young people have diagnoses of autism or have at least ASD characteristics. Around 35% of the referrals to the NHS service have ASD characteristics. In the general population, it's around 1%. Again, a big difference there. Very many of the young people being referred have mental health diagnoses existing, depression, OCD, different things like that, at much higher rates than teenagers in general. Many are experiencing same-sex attraction. A recent observation people made is many more looked after children in care are questioning their gender identity than kind of would be statistically balanced to the broader population. So not only are there many more people questioning their gender, but also there seem to be specific characteristics that make a young person more likely to question their gender. And a final important thing we're observing is now that this has been going for 10 years, we're seeing many people who were in the earlier kind of groups of young people identifying this way, who are reaching their early 20s and their mid-20s and are what we call detransitioning. So they transition to living line of how they felt inside. Often it is biological females who transition to live as boys, reach their early 20s, realise transitioning hasn't delivered on what they thought it would, hasn't solved the problems they thought it would, and actually they're looking back and saying, actually I realised that I was maybe really shaped by stereotypes, and I didn't fit in as a girl, so I thought I must be a boy. Or saying, actually, I was attracted to other girls, and I subconsciously kind of was a bit unsettled by that, and I came to the belief that being a boy would be easier. It's interesting that increasingly young people say, actually, this wasn't the answer to change my gender. There were other things going on. There are no official records of detransitioners, sadly, and often they're not very helped by the medical services and such like. So it's very hard to know the numbers. We just don't know how many people have detransitioned, how likely that is, how often that is. But anecdotal evidence suggests the numbers are quite large and are increasing. One very unscientific measure is a Reddit chat board, which is like an online kind of discussion community. The D-Trans Reddit chat, where people who are detransitioners share their stories, share advice and stuff. Launched in 2017, with 20 people. By January 2020, had 8,000 members. Now, 2 years later, has over 40,000 members. It seems there are significant numbers of people saying, we transitioned, this hasn't helped us, what do we do? And all of this, basically, the huge increase in numbers, the noticeable features of these young people that aren't correlative to the rest of the population, the detransitionist stories, all of them are rightly raising questions of what is going on and why is this happening? And most importantly, how do we best love and care for young people in this context? And so we want to talk about understandings of what's going on. And there are two basically very different, kind of opposing almost perspectives on what's going on and explanations of what's happening. One of those is called the diversity perspective, or rather I call it the diversity perspective. I think that's a helpful name for it. This would be the view presented by many kind of LGBT and trans charities, by prominent influencers on the internet, the view often actually put forward by schools and in schools' materials, and certainly the most common view held among young people and kind of shared between them. And this view links to some of the identity stuff we've talked already today. It talks about us having a gender identity, built on something called gender identity theory, the theory every single one of us as a human has this thing called a gender identity, that it's a true part of us, a key part of us, and that it reveals who we really are. It's an either-side identity. We embrace what we find inside as who we are. And gender identity theory says that's who you really are. And so things like your body, your community, how people talk about you, think about you, that all needs to change to match up with what's inside. As this view would say, a teenager knows who they are and would say only they know who they are. So our job is to listen to them and to affirm them in who they feel themselves to be and to help them to live that out. So a diversity perspective would be quite favourable of and quite encouraging of transition, of moving to live in line of gender identity. And they would look at what's happened in the last 10 years, and they would say that the huge increase we're seeing is just a result of the fact it's much safer to come out as trans, and there's kind of more understanding, there's more kind of visibility going on. They say we're a much more accepting culture, so it's just safe for what's always been there to actually be revealed and kind of be talked about. And what we're seeing is just the kind of emerging of the natural diversity of humanity. Always been there, they say, but just now is the first time we're really having the freedom to see that happen. And so it's the diversity perspective, because it explains this phenomenon by just saying this is just natural, normal diversity in humanity. But I think there are some quite significant problems with that. The diversity perspective really struggles to account for the actual evidence we're seeing. If this is just the natural diversity of humanity emerging, why is this happening primarily, almost solely among teenagers, and that at all ages? Why are there not lots of people in later life saying, oh yeah, I've always felt that way too, I need to transition too? It doesn't really explain that. Also doesn't explain why we are seeing primarily young females, not young males, now questioning their gender identity and coming out as trans. Why has that switch happened from predominantly males to predominantly females? Why are we not seeing lots of women in later life saying, yes, actually, that's me too, I must be trans too? It can't offer any explanation for that. And it can't explain to us why is it that this natural diversity of humanity is more common among young people who have pre-existing mental health diagnoses or in some way neurodiverse characteristics or are same-sex attracted in different things. This kind of perspective just really can't account for the reality of the evidence we're seeing. And that's on top of the fact there's just no good kind of basis or evidence for gender identity theory. It's not a scientific theory, it's not a scientific discovery. It's kind of a combination of modern philosophy and experience kind of mixed in together to make a quasi-scientific theory. You can't do a test to find someone's gender identity, you can't do a scan to find it. There'd actually be questions of what does that even mean. The diversity perspective, I think, is quite problematic, though it's very common in our culture. And so the alternative perspective, I think it's more helpful, I would term the distress perspective. This is an increasingly common view. Increasing number of clinicians are taking this kind of view, academics, parents, certain charities. Interestingly, quite a lot of older trans people who've been transitioned for many decades in some cases are looking at what's going on and saying this is radically different to their experience. There's something else going on. The new NHS guidelines that have been published just a couple of weeks ago largely support this kind of perspective, certainly much more than the diversity perspective. So I think this is a positive thing. We're on a journey to our NHS treatment of young people being, I think, much more led by the evidence and more on this line. Distress perspective rejects gender identity theory because there's just no evidence for it in a sense, and does say our identity as a boy or a girl, man or woman, is rooted in our body. And so it looks at what's going on. It seems that trans experience and gender dysphoria, they're not revealing true identity, but they are revealing the fact that many teenagers are distressed and are looking for an explanation to that and looking for a solution to that. That actually trans has become the explanation. If you're a teenager and you're feeling distressed, you're told, well, that's because you're trans. And we're in a society that wants quick fixes and easy solutions, that thinks all suffering should be easily solvable. And the solution given to young people is transitioning. And so they hear the YouTubers saying, I was miserable and I didn't fit in, it was awful, and then I started taking testosterone, this young female will say. Or then I had a mastectomy, I had my breast chopped off, and now life is wonderful. And young people are being sold a salvation narrative of your distress is because you're trans and transitioning is the solution. And of course, distress is very common among teenagers. Any of us, well, all of us have been teenagers. Many of us remember, they're not easy years. Many, many of us in different ways experience distress at that time. That can just be puberty. Puberty can be a rough ride, a difficult time for young people. Puberty is rooted in your body. It's totally unsurprising if young people finding puberty difficult feel very uncomfortable in their body. And the appeal of changing and almost escaping the power of the body is very strong in that context. But also notice many of those things that mark this group of young people out and are not statistically in keeping with the rest of the population are potential causes of distress. Mental ill health is distressing. Children with young people with neurodiverse characteristics will often be struggling to fit in and maybe struggling to engage in social contexts and things like that. That could be very distressing for them. A young person beginning to experience same-sex sexuality, even our culture, can find that very unsettling and distressing. I think this makes sense of the evidence. We've got a whole cohort of teenagers who, for understandable reasons, are feeling distressed, and they're receiving a salvation narrative or a kind of promise of escape from them. And so the distress perspective says actually trans identification has become a contagious idea. And we know that happens. That suicide, we know, is a contagious idea. We've seen it happen, especially among teenage girls, with self-harm, with eating disorders, where you get a friendship group where a large number of them start to suffer the same thing around a similar time. We know these things can become contagious ideas, especially among young people. That seems to be what has happened. And therefore, this perspective would say the solution isn't to affirm young people in what they feel and say, yes, we need to help you to transition, but actually is to help them explore different ways they might be feeling distressed, is in a sense to not focus on gender as the big issue, because probably gender isn't the issue, but actually to explore other things that are going on in young people's lives and make sure they're receiving good support if there are mental health things going on. Make sure they're beginning to understand how their brain works, actually, if they're autistic or have ASD characteristics. Different ways of helping them come to terms with, I guess, face the distress they're experiencing, potentially finding ways to alleviate that. Sometimes that's not possible. Sometimes it's how do we build resilience to help young people walk through life which can be distressing. So in this view, the huge increase is that teenagers are in distress, as so many of us are as teenagers, and this idea is spreading that trans is the solution for it. And I think that's just heavily supported by the evidence. It explains why this is primarily happening to teenagers. It explains why it's primarily happening to females. Sadly, it's probably more distressing to be a female teenager at the moment than it is a male teenager. It explains why these young people are not representative of the population, and there's all those factors that might cause them distress. Detransitioner stories, almost without fail, fit this pattern. I was autistic and I had such a black and white way of thinking, a person might say, that I thought I can't fit into the girl box, I must be a boy. Or actually I was so unhappy because of my mental health, this said it would solve that problem, I went to that as the solution. It fits with the stories we're seeing. And it fits with the evidence of influences. Very often we are seeing multiple young people in the same friendship group, which could be a contagious idea. Very often you see a young person withdraws from kind of in-person life with in-person friends and stuff, spends a lot of time on the internet, and soon afterwards comes out as trans. Or very often you hear the narrative of, I always kind of knew I was different, I always kind of didn't quite fit in, then I came across the trans YouTubers, or then I came across trans Reddit, and it explained who I am and why this is happening. Usually the influence that has influenced the young person is literally explicitly there in the story they will tell of what has happened. And there's very strong evidence, and I think this fits with the biblical perspective. The picture I've tried to paint this morning, that our identity is given to us in our bodies, not in what we feel inside, maps onto this here. And some of us will find we get discomfort or have
discomfort around that given identity. But the way we thrive and flourish actually is by receiving from God our identity, finding the ways to find peace with that and navigate that. I think this does mean young people are best supported by being supported to kind of explore the other factors and what might be going on separate from gender and making peace with the body God has given them. Let's pause to have 2 minutes talking to each other, because I've just bombarded you with a whole load of information and understanding. I hope some of it was helpful, you got it. Turn to the person next to you. What was helpful? What confused you? What are your thoughts? And then we'll come to, if that's what's going on, how do we be God's better community? Just a couple of minutes to stretch your brains in that way. Oh,
oh, no,
that's it. It was on hold.
No, that turns it off.
No, hold stops it from accidentally pressing buttons and closing your pocket.
Oh, I see that.
Yeah. So press record?
Yeah.
I always think a good hubbub is encouraging. Well, it either means it was really helpful or you're really confused, but we'll find out in Q&A which one of those it was. Let's now start to talk about, if that is potentially what's going on and we want to love and care for young people well, what might it look like to build God's better community for these young people? The way that we as churches, as church family, as families in our communities can be building a better community. And I want to give you, I think it's 5 things that I think are helpful foundations for us when we do that. And hopefully we'll get through these with a bit of time for a little bit of Q&A and discussion at the end. One thing I think helps us to be God's better community for these young people is to build communities of belonging and acceptance. We want to be genuine community. Community is the right word. I'm glad it's in the title of this session. Community is a theme in the story of trans teens. If you listen to some of the stories, and I encourage you to do so, do it online, there's all over the place. So many young people say, actually, when I realized I was trans, when I came out as trans, I found this online trans community. I found a place I could belong. I found a place where it was safe to ask my questions. I found a place where I was accepted just for me and just for how I am. And you hear, oh, this was a young person who is desperate for community. And we all know if we're feeling distressed, what do we want? We want to be loved and feel like we're safe in community. Very often that's what young people find by coming out as trans and entering into the trans world online or LGBT groups at school and different things like that. And actually, we had the chance to offer a better community, actually, of belonging. Because, of course, it should be that church is the place where every person can come and be loved, be welcomed in, can find a sense of belonging, a sense of community, a sense of family. We get to provide, in a better way, what actually young people are looking for. And so I think one of the tasks for us as churches in our day and age is, how do we provide teenagers with better, richer experiences of community? That is a genuine challenge for kind of youth work today. How do we provide better, richer experiences of community than the online world? Because let's be honest, that's basically the rest of the community for young people. How do we facilitate close friendships? How do we create safe context to ask questions? So young people don't think they need to go to some chat board online to be safe to ask whatever questions they have, but actually they know church community is a context where it's safe, to be honest, to ask questions. I think we need to prioritise creating in-person contacts. The last few years have taught us that, haven't they? The incredible value and importance of being in person, having embodied relationships, being alongside each other in the same room. It's interesting to me that kind of the online life is a disembodied life, isn't it? You're there in mind, in a sense, not in body, and young people have these avatars, these, you know, virtual figures they play in games and stuff, and that's an interesting correlation with trans-identifying boys particularly. Very often before a boy comes out as trans, they've been in the kind of gaming world, they've had an avatar, this kind of internet persona, which is where they've been trying out an alternative identity. We need to get young people back into the real world, an embodied world, into real community. We need to help teenagers know they're loved, they're welcome, they're valued, we value their questions, that no question is too stupid, no question is out of bounds. It's okay and good and safe to do that. So the challenge for us as churches is, how do we do that in our youth groups? Actually, offering the simple thing of in-person, genuine community could be one of the most important and powerful things that churches can do for teenagers today. I think it's also a challenge for parents, thinking how could you make your family and your home an experience of genuine community for teenagers with whom you're connected to, probably through your own teenagers, your own family. And I think all of us have a role to play in setting an example of us being communities of belongings and acceptance. All of us have a role to play in setting an example of valuing friendship. Teenagers very often have quite a low view of friendship, hence the kind of quest for belonging online, or the quest for a romantic relationship, because they're told that's where belonging comes. Why do they think that? Partly because culture's like that, but maybe also because we're often like that. Actually, do we send the message that friendship is important? That deep, meaningful friendship is possible and valuable and a genuine experience of love and community and acceptance? Children are never going to think friendships are important if they don't see us modelling that. That's a role for all of us to play. Likewise, I think speaking highly of friendship. We can easily speak highly of marriage, and we might even talk about praying for our children's future spouse and things like that. We never talk so much about the importance of friendship. We should be talking up friendship. Jesus uses friendship to define love. He gives it incredible value. You ever notice John 15? Jesus wants to define friendship. Doesn't use marriage, doesn't use love. Define love, doesn't use marriage, doesn't use sex. He uses friendship. Greater love has no man than this, that he laid down his life for his friends. How can I get them to understand love? I know. Friendship. It's challenging. We want to talk up friendship, show the value of it. And we want to show that we're people who are up for open and honest, tough conversations. If you're a parent, find the appropriate way of showing a young person you have big questions too. It's okay to ask them. It's okay to not know all the answers. It's okay to be wrestling with things. So our young people know this is the safe place to do that. You've not got to run off to your bedroom and go online to do that. Communities of belonging and acceptance, I think, are going to help young people. And then also communities of attentive listening, where we listen well, which very much really is part of the belonging and acceptance thing. Listening communicates love and value, doesn't it? When someone really listens to us, we feel, oh, yeah, you love me, you are valuing me even in just doing that. We want to show young people we care about them. We value them just as they are as people by listening well. And that's especially important if we disagree with their perspective. If your teenager comes out as trans to you as a parent or you as a youth leader, the worst thing you can do is stop listening and start telling. The best thing you can do is just listen. It may be really hard to listen to. You may fundamentally disagree with everything they're saying, but listening shows, I care about what you think. I care about what you're going through. I care about understanding. So I'm treating you as a real person, an emerging adult, and listening to love you well. As we listen, we can listen out for the distress. Chances are this young person is some ways distressed, and that's quite possibly understandable. We can validate that. It must be so hard to feel that way. I didn't know that was going on, but I can't imagine how that must be feeling for you. Again, we're validating, we care about you, we love you, and this distress is kind of genuine and real. We listen to love, it expresses love. That's the first priority. We're also listening to learn, because we want to really understand what's going on for this young person. As I said, just because we've come to this seminar or read some stuff online or whatever doesn't mean we understand what's going on for every trans-identifying teen. Listening to them as an individual helps us understand what's going on. We're looking out for, maybe there are some unhelpful thoughts about stereotypes going on. Maybe actually we're already aware there is some potentially some mental health difficulties going on. Different things, and just thinking actually, gender, okay, is something to talk about, but maybe there are other things we should talk about as well. And so I think open-ended questions are helpful from that listening. How long have you been feeling like this? What do you mean when you say you don't feel you fit in? What do you mean when you say you feel actually you are a girl and not a boy? Just allowing them to speak and attentively listening. The third one won't be a surprise. I should say it is God-decided identity. You want communities of God-decided identity because it does all come down to identity. The I decide narrative is being preached so loudly at young people. I think for those of us not in the kind of youth culture context, it might be hard for us to appreciate how prominent that message is. We need to help young people from the youngest age take hold of this thing of God decides identity, to see and experience its goodness. If you're a youth leader or a church leader or a parent, one of the most important things you can talk to young people about is identity. And think about opportunities to do that. Think about the things that you and they are watching, or the lyrics of songs they're listening to, or experiences that you and they have, and how you can use those as a springboard to talk about identity and purpose and value and worth. Be open about, again, your own struggles on those kind of areas, actually, in an appropriate way, showing we're all wrestling with these things, all trying to find the answers to these things. Discuss it explicitly, but also demonstrate it implicitly. I'm convinced that when we understand God decides identity, it impacts how we relate to other people. We relate to them not based on their achievements, as it's others decide, not based on what they're feeling inside, but based on what God says they are, who they are. I think that affects how we affirm our young people as parents and youth leaders. Yes, we praise successes, but actually also make sure that's not the only time we praise, because their value isn't in their successes, their value is in who they are. I think it shapes discipline. Gospel-centered discipline, I think, actually is rooted in a good understanding of identity. Children should be not just being taught identity from us, but also catching it from us. It's not just taught, it's caught in how we interact and how we live. And under this kind of umbrella of identity comes, I think, gender stereotypes. So again, I've talked about those a bit already today. These fixed, rigid ideas of what men and women are like, the narrow boxes we should fit in. We need to help young people see that isn't what makes us a man or woman. We don't need to try and fit ourselves into those boxes, showing the freeing nature, actually, of Christian teaching here. And that's something we can do something about. Sometimes there's a place to directly challenge it, I think, actually. No, I think I'm a boy because of this. Well, why can't girls be like that? Why can't girls do that? We can lead by example. One of the best things you can do is being confident in how you are. The vast majority of us find we don't match up to all gender stereotypes. I've rarely met anyone who says, yeah, every single gender stereotype ticks the box for me. Actually, being really confident about that and living that out just demonstrates to young people that's okay. One of the most lovely and meaningful things a guy in my church said to me, he one day thanked me for showing his sons a different way of being a man. And actually, that was the night after I'd been at an 18th birthday party with these boys, so I kind of thought, what did I do and what did they say when they got home? But still, the point was, they were seeing you don't have to be the stereotypical macho man to still be a man, and they were learning that from my example. Just by being confident in who we are, we can actually lead by example. And watching words, especially jokes, that's a place often that gender stereotypes come out. Just being careful, thinking, are we unintentionally reaffirming gender stereotypes in things we say? We want communities of God decides identity. We also want communities with a healthy view of suffering. We said that what seems to be going on is that young people are suffering. They are experiencing distress in different ways, different levels. And the diversity perspective presents a salvation narrative, a rescue from distress and suffering in the explanation of trans and the kind of promise of the solution of transitioning. We need to help young people have a healthier view of suffering and of how we navigate it, how we build resilience to walk through life. I think a healthy view of suffering is not what our culture has. No, our culture has this view of suffering is not how things should be. It's things going wrong and should be easily solvable. We're so confident in our abilities now as modern Westerners post the Enlightenment, we think that we can solve everything. There's always going to be an answer. There'll always be technology or a medical intervention or something to solve everything. We're very uncomfortable with accepting the reality if we live in a world marred by sin, some suffering will be unavoidable and will be a feature of all of our lives until Jesus returns. Now, of course, we have the good news of there is a genuine solution to suffering. We're the only ones who can say suffering really will one day end forever. And here's how you can experience that. But in this life, actually, a healthy view of suffering is inevitable. It's normal. It's part of life. You can show young people your experience in distress. Yes, so am I sometimes. That's just a normal part of life. When we're told that we deserve to not suffer and to have the easy solutions, we tell young people, actually, the reality is suffering is here to stay often, but there's ways we can navigate through that. We use the Bible's big story. The Bible's big story explains for us why some things are not as they should be. Well, we all feel that tension between, I feel like life shouldn't be like this. Yeah, it shouldn't be, because sin has infected the world. Then the story also tells us, and there's a day coming when it won't be like this. There's one who's putting all things to rights, and we get invited in to be part of that story. And scripture is really clear that even though we find it hard to do, because we don't think about death much, and death feels so far away for many of us, we are meant to set our sights on the end of the story. We're meant to set our sights on the new creation. That does help us persevere now by knowing what's coming then. We look at all the different ways the Bible equips us to face suffering, including things like lament. You're meant to feel your suffering. You're meant to allow yourself to feel the emotion and express the emotion, not kind of thinking, I've got to express the emotion over here and then I can come to God. And I'm coming to God saying, God, this hurts. I'm hurting. I'm distressed. Teaching young people a healthy way of handling difficult emotions and having the help of the church, the people of God, and the help of the Spirit of God, the God of all comfort, with us as well. I think a priority for us of our young people is building resilience. They're being told by our culture that they are not resilient. They are being told that they're incredibly fragile, to the level of if someone uses the wrong pronoun for you, that is violence against you. That's what you're being told. That makes you incredibly fragile. What we need to say is you are created by God in his image. You're this amazing, resilient, tough human being thing that God has created. You can face lots of stuff. We need to build our young people up, not cover them in cotton wool. You're really fragile. You're going to get really damaged. No. You're created by God in his image. Life's not going to be easy, but you're far more resilient than you think you are. We don't want to belittle pain and suffering. We do want to put it in perspective and empower young people. Sometimes there will be things that can be done. It is important that actually if there are mental health things going on, if there are neurodiverse characteristics, whatever it might be, that appropriate different forms of support and understanding are sought. Often stereotypes are at play. So talking around that, challenging those can be really helpful. In some cases, in many cases, it is a case of waiting. For many young people, it is puberty. Puberty is tough, but puberty ends. We can all reassure young people, you do get through puberty and you get out the other side and it is okay. We were there once too, we know what it's like, but actually it is something you go through and it is actually a positive thing. Another thing, the positivity of puberty. Puberty we tend to talk about is a really negative thing. Isn't it amazing that God's created it, that through this little period of life, we transform from children to adults, ready to live adult life? That's an amazing thing. Isn't it amazing your body is developing? Because God one day might choose to give you children, might call you into a relationship where you can have children. Isn't it amazing your brain is developing so you can do these incredible things? That's what puberty should be like. And yeah, there's some difficulty in painting it, but this is exciting. And actually, we only talk negatively about puberty. Of course, it's really distressing and really tough for a young person. We can help them in the midst of that. We want to prepare our young people so when they hear the false salvation narrative of our culture, it doesn't have quite the power and appeal that it might otherwise do. And we want finally to be a community with a rounded view of discipleship. I think across the board, it's very easy for us to make following Jesus and being a disciple of Jesus sound somewhat like the trans narrative, i.e. sound like a shortcut, quick fix to a happy and easy life. I sometimes in my own church context even notice this. I'm worried that so often testimonies are life was awful, then I met Jesus, now life is amazing. But we all know it's not the case. Anyone who's been a Christian for more than a few weeks or days maybe knows it's not as simple as that. The gospel is, I was awful, Jesus welcomed me in, and now life's still pretty awful, but Jesus is with me, and I can get through this, and there's a day coming when life won't be awful. We've got to make sure we get the gospel right, and that includes a rounded view of discipleship, that it's not a life is suddenly easy, life is perfect, no challenges come. But it is entering into fullness of life, because we're in a relationship with the Creator who loves us and delights over us. But in that there's cost. Jesus says there's costs. He says we're carrying a cross. He says we lose our life to gain our life. Losing our life sounds pretty painful, but it is through that that we gain our life. We need to help young people expect that following Jesus, if they choose to do so, will not always be an easy path. But that is totally normal. And for a young person choosing out of faithfulness to Jesus, that in that everything in me wants to transition, and all my friends say the solution is transitioning, I love Jesus, I'm trusting him, I'm carrying my cross. We need to get to a place where that's not a surprise for a young person, because that's normal Christian life. That's what we should all be doing all the time. They should look at us and say, well, you're carrying your cross. I can carry my cross. I can keep going with this. We need to communicate a full gospel and view of discipleship. So we have that expectation of the reality and demonstrate it. There's a role for each one of us to count the cost ourselves, be setting an example in that. A few initial thoughts, five things that maybe help us to form the kind of communities I think would help us to love and care for and reach out to maybe trans-identifying teens. Only a starting point, but I think some important ones we can use. Community of belonging and acceptance, community of attentive listening, of God-decides identity, with a healthy view of suffering and a rounded view of discipleship. Let's do 2 more minutes of what struck you, what's helpful, what do you disagree with, what's the question you want to ask, and then we'll come back and we'll have about 10 minutes to have a discussion, have a bit of Q&A. So chatting with each other for a few moments.
When you say get back together, is there any comments? There's nothing. Like, you've just been talking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they can hear me, they're just not listening to me. Stuart has pointed out that you can't now claim to not have questions because you've all had so much to talk about. So we're expecting plenty of questions to come through. Very happy to take questions. I don't promise to have all the answers. I said this is a new phenomenon. We're kind of trying to grasp at what's going on, how do we best serve, but it is healthy for us to be having these conversations. So questions, disagreements, pushbacks, anything you want to bring. Yeah, go for it, please.
I mean, all this advice you give is very good, I'm sure, but how do we deal with the fact that this has become an academic and even state-sponsored ideology?
Really, good.
That's the real issue.
So we can do our local-level stuff. What happens at the high-level stuff? Really good question, yeah. I mean, various things. One is pray. Pray for people who are doing really good work, actually, at the kind of policy level and different things. Pray for the current NHS CAST review, which is the thing that's leading to these new specifications. Once we have enshrined in NHS policy and government policy the fact that what we've been doing has probably been harming children, and the fact that we need to find a better way of helping them, that is the change many of us who work in this area have been hoping and praying for years. I thought it would happen, I didn't happen this quickly. So praying for that. There's actually a consultation open on that. So one thing is to Google the CAST review consultation, and actually organisations like Christian Institute and CMF would give you some advice on how to respond to the consultation, saying to the government, this seems to make really good sense. We agree we should be safeguarding young people in this way. Supporting charities like Transgender Trend, a secular charity, but doing excellent work again at the policy level with schools, policymakers, different people like that. For a small number of us, there might be a calling into that, especially if you are in education, in politics, in the medical field. It might be that God's calling you to one of the people who put your head above the parapet to learn about this, to speak out. Because what it takes is those prophetic voices to speak out so people get heard and things start to change, which they are, which is really good. So you're absolutely right. There's a whole other level which isn't where I've been touching on today. But I also think this level is so important. I just think as we're working through this on the policy level, there's going to be a whole load of collateral damage. And I want it to be the church that are the home for the hurting. Yeah, actually, we are going to have thousands of young people in their early 20s feeling so hurt by what was done to them, longing for acceptance, longing to know who they are, all this kind of stuff. Wouldn't it be amazing if what became the default thing is, where can I go to find home and love and support? The church. Isn't that amazing? What an opportunity for the love of God to be shown. So it's both and the thing. That's helpful. Thank you. Any more? Yeah, go for it.
Thanks for that. It's really helpful. It's implied in, I think, all that we're saying, that really God is the only answer. And by that, what I mean is this. Everything that you say works once we accept God. Mm-hmm. But for as long as people, for people that don't get converted to the Christian faith,
yeah.
How what about them? And you said the thousands that are going to feel hurt. Well, unless they actually are converted to the Christian faith, are you saying we haven't really got anything much to say to them, kind of thing? For example, the acceptance and all of that.
Yeah.
It's not going to work, is it?
I don't think I am saying that. I think one thing I'm saying is we need to get good at preaching the gospel in the key it needs to be heard. So we need to get good at showing people how the gospel meets where they're at. So we're not in a society that's very aware of its sin and is racked with guilt. We are in a society that's longing for acceptance, to know who they are, all that kind of stuff. We need to find ways of saying the gospel in that key, which doesn't downplay the reality of sin. That's the opposite end of it. So there's that. There's the interesting reality that basically what people are realising is it really is better to listen to your body than your internal self. Again, that's an opportunity to us. If your body is just a result of natural selection, millions of years of random genetic mutations, there is no reason to listen to your body to determine who you are. The seedbed for the gospel here is huge. But I think we can still, we want to be places. I think we do want to be a place where people can belong before they believe. I think, there's a difference of being in a church community when you're not a Christian, because you're not part of the family in the sense of related to us as a fellow child of God. But we do want you to feel loved and welcome. We want to love our neighbours, as Jesus says. So I think we can do a lot of the belonging acceptance stuff, especially for young people who are just desperate for community, desperate for someone who takes a genuine interest in their life. I love people like Rachel Gardner from Youthscape on this, and she's like, some of the best ways we can serve young people today as youth leaders, is her context, it's being the people who turn up. What's going to make most impact on a young person you're serving actually is when you turn up at their sports event, or their concert, or their drama thing, whatever it is, being people who take genuine interest in their lives. They might be Christians or not, but we are showing some loving acceptance in that. So you're right, the answer is the gospel. And it's the same with all the identity stuff I've said, and it's a problem for secular psychologists. You know, they're trying to tell people not to root their identity what people think of them, or the fact they've lost their job or whatever, but they have no solid foundation to give. They know the issue is identity, they have no foundation. I think that's a seabed for the gospel, but I think also we can do some good work even without that, which is the common grace of God, isn't it? That even outside of his saving grace, he is good to us as humanity.
Can I just come back as well with on the sort of acceptance, which people are certainly searching for. One of the difficulties there is for them, acceptance is affirmation of their identity. And so the one reason why they may not come to a church that will accept them is because you won't or don't affirm that aspect of them.
Yeah.
So have you got any kind of wisdom about how we manage this acceptance of them? But the inability to affirm their conclusions about their identity.
Yeah, which is a problem we have broad across society as we're seeking to reach out to people in general, isn't it? Yeah, that is very difficult. I think the ideal world, what we want to do is undermine people's assumption that we're these horrible people by the way we love them. So the dream scenario for us as Christians going forward in increasingly secularized society is, you're a Christian, you have these abhorrent views, and yet you really love me, and you really care for me, and you gave up all that time when I was, you know, moving house to help me, whatever. I think we've got to be much more deliberate about building meaningful, deep connections with people where they experience the fact that we love them. So then they're just like, these people with abhorrent views really love me. We kind of take them by surprise. That's not easy when it's, no, a young person's come to a youth group for the first time, thinks you're awful because you don't agree with who they are. But I do think we can still show ways that, even, you know, when the young person is arguing at you and shouting in your face, even the way you're responding and you're loving to them and you say they're always welcome, that kind of stuff, they're going to go home and think, that was weird. That horrible person, even when I'm shouting in their face, they were quite nice to me. I don't know, I think there's something about embodying love which is going to disarm people. But you're absolutely right, it's one of the biggest challenges we are facing and going to face. Yeah?
I think you're so right, and especially as given what you said about if we acknowledge that the dramatic increase in people identifying on the money labels is hurt, and suffering, and I guess we have a big answer to that. So instead of hearing I am trans, hearing I am hurt, I think we have much more skills to love into that, don't we?
That's really good, thank you. Yeah. Let's go for one more. Sorry, I saw you first. Go for you.
Kind of going off that as well, in terms of loving and accepting people, if a young person comes to you and they say, I'd like you to use my preferred pronouns, which is opposite to their, like, gender.
Yeah.
Some Christians, it's probably a Christian thing, but it's widely debated in terms of, if I accept those pronouns, then it's going to reaffirm and that they're not made in the, like, God's image, or it's going to completely build up a wall that I can't share the gospel with them.
It's the hardest when the rubber hits the road question. I think it is a wisdom thing, a case-by-case conscience thing. A few principles, my encouragement to youth leaders always, I do think parents need to take the lead in the whole thing. As a base, I think youth leaders should be taking the lead from the parents. Certain youth leaders shouldn't use preferred pronouns if parents don't. I think that's quite important, really. And I think what youth leaders in that situation, have a conversation with the parents, and if they know none of this, start pointing to helpful resources and stuff. Because, and again, we're helped both new NHS guidance. The NHS guidance used to be, you assume the child is who they say you are, who they say they are, use whatever names, pronouns and stuff you want. The default now is you don't do that. The default in the new NHS specification is, we know that even using different pronouns and names affirms, as you say, who they are, makes it less like kids will naturally go away, makes it harder for them to revert to living a line of biological sex in the future. So the policy basically says, unless there's significant clinical levels of distress that's debilitating in daily life, even clinicians won't do that. Now, we're not the NHS and we don't want to treat young people as if we are, but that's a helpful authority of, actually, we're just not sure it's the best thing for you. So for the time being, let's avoid pronouns or use gender neutral or whatever. And these policy level things are going to help us actually to be treating young people responsibly, even while navigating those difficult relational things.